The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 275, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins, a panel featuring Mel Tungate, John Charles Duffy, Bill Hansen, and Grant H. Palmer.
To welcome you to this afternoon's final session, and before introducing the topic and our panelists, I've been asked to announce that there will be a reception immediately following this session in the Rap of the Gavel Room, which is right down the hall, for the new and the retiring editorial team for Dialogue. It will go from 6:30 to 7:30. Refreshments will be served, and I've not been told if that includes Jell-O. This is Session 275, Author Meets Critics, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins. I mentioned, first of all, that a copy of the book is available through Benchmark Books in the vendor section today. The author is Grant Palmer, holds a master's degree in American history from BYU, and is a three-time director of LDS Institutes of Religion, California and Utah, and a former instructor at the Church College of New Zealand, LDS seminary teacher at two Utah locations. He's been active in the Mormon History Association and on the board of directors, the Salt Lake Legal Defenders Association, and in his local LDS ward is the High Priest Group instructor. Our panelists are, first of all, Mel Tungate from Hollister, California. He's an amateur historian with an interest in Mormon history, and is an active church member. John Charles Duffy has a bachelor's degree in English from BYU and a master's in English from the University of Utah, and is currently a writing instructor at the University of Utah, preparing to pursue a doctorate in religious studies. He's an officer in the Association for Mormon Letters, an editorial assistant for Sunstone, and a founding member for Mormons for Equality and Social Justice. And our final panelist is Bill Hansen. He's a graduate from the J. Reuben Clark Law School in 1980 and has a general practice of law in Payson, Utah. In his bio, he states that he's interested in commercial development, birth defects, hypnotherapy, and the nose flute. In addition to Joseph Smith and Midrashic revelation, he particularly enjoys conventional relationships, and I'll let him explain that so that we can add an air of mystery to today's session. Thank you.
I want to thank Sunstone for having me part of the panel. My name is Mel Tungate. I think one of the reasons, at least what John Hatch said he wanted me, is I've been active in the church since I was blessed as a baby. In spite of the fact being very open in my skepticism of much of the history, as I was taught it in the church as a youth, and definitely as I certainly understand it now. I teach gospel doctrine in my ward, in spite of my unorthodox way of also probably doing that. I quote Raymond Brown, who I will quote in a few minutes more in my gospel doctrine class than I do any other theologian. For those who don't know, he is not a general authority of the Mormon Church. I want to first thank Graham Palmer for his braveness and for his marvelously written and well-researched book. Recently deceased Father Raymond Brown, who I've already mentioned, is the foremost English-speaking authority on the New Testament. He was a Catholic theologian of great renown, was revered by Christians and non-Christians alike. Among his 100-plus scholarly works are his magnificent Birth of the Messiah, Death of the Messiah, Introduction into the New Testament. But one of my favorites is his responses to 101 questions of the Bible, in which he tells how he personally views some of the things he writes from a scholarly manner. In his 101 book, as well as some other scholarly works, he discusses quite openly that Brothers of Jesus which is mentioned three times in the Bible in Matthew, Mark, and Galatians, means that Christ probably had literal brothers. He writes, and I quote, "The brothers of Jesus is not Protestant language. It is biblical language." This is, of course, is in direct contrast to the official position of the church that he represents. Father Brown later stated, quote, "We Roman Catholics should abstain from considering unchristian those who interpret the New Testament to say that Christ had literal brothers and sisters," end quote. Think of how much personal integrity and strength it took for the faithful Father, Catholic Father Brown, to write that, and about how great his influence was because Raymond Brown, a prominent believing Catholic theologian, took that position. Grant Palmer has done for early Mormon beginnings what Raymond Brown did for Catholic doctrine and history. Both wrote the truth as they researched it, and both interpreted in light of their continuing faithful beliefs. Grant did this, much as Father Brown did it, in a nice but direct manner. Simply speaking, Grant Palmer put in one place the scholarly historical research of the past two decades concerning the coming forth of the Church and the Book of Mormon, as well as plowing some new ground. He openly stated his lifelong CES position, as was mentioned in his introduction, the same as Father Brown openly stated that he was coming from a position of faithful Catholicism, much as Craig Cower did in his closing chapter of his well-done book that will be discussed later on in this conference. While some others have written from the same position, I'm thinking of a man in the audience named Todd Compton, such a position sometimes is not the norm. People who remain faithful sometimes are leery of what they say. They pull their punches. Grant has shown us the way to speak directly with historical accuracy and treat troublesome facts in a direct way. I hope that this trend, at least I think I'm seeing a trend, continues. Grant's position with direct treating of troublesome LDS topics, yet maintaining his faithful position in the church, has great power. He spends 258 pages directly discussing the historical evidence concerning the First Vision, the Book of Mormon, the other Joseph Smith, quote and unquote, translations, and the priesthood restorations. Basically, he destroys the historical LDS position using well-established facts, but does so in a kind, faithful way. Then Grant gives a great concluding chapter, a chapter that should be read by every Mormon. Let me quote part of it. He summarizes the book's preceding pages and says, and I'm going to quote for a little while here, quote, "I cherish Joseph Smith's teaching on many topics, such as the plan of salvation and his view that the marriage covenant extends beyond death. Many others could be enumerated. But when it comes to the founding events, I wonder if they are trustworthy as history." That would have to be the understatement of the year. The issue of his, meaning Joseph Smith's, credibility in differentiating between history and allegory initially filled me with a sense of loss. But I realized that the focus of my worship as a Mormon is Jesus Christ. As I learn more about our history, I arrive at a greater commitment to Christ's teachings. I have pursued what might be considered to be a more practical approach to our religion, an emphasis on the character of Jesus Christ and his promises. Then a page or so later, in his summarizing concluding chapter, he says, "As Latter-day Saints, our religious faith should be based and evaluated by how our spiritual and moral lives are centered in Jesus Christ, rather than in Joseph Smith's largely rewritten, materialistic, idealized, and controversial account of our church's founding. I hope that this study contributes in some way towards that end." That just about states what I believe has happened in my life. I can only say that Grant and I have made the same journey. His was much tougher. He did so as part of the CES organization. I can only imagine the pressure he was under. I'm a math guy. I'm in business. They left me alone. I personally thank him for accompanying me on the journey of staying strong in the church while researching our troublesome history. And I want to thank him for now leading me on that self-same journey. Maybe the official LDS Church Office Building's silent reception of Grant's book is a sign that the church organization has matured. I'm not sure of that. Maybe it is. They've matured enough to accept hearing the historical truth from someone on the inside. If so, that also is a nice step. There can be a direct contrast drawn between the reception that they officially made to Grant tearing away the very foundation of the historical stories that were told to us, some in official scripture, and the scathing press releases and denunciation of Krakauer's book. And he tore at the periphery of the church by people not even members of the church. Now, Krakauer touched on some of our troublesome history, but I'll submit to you the activity at some of the things like Crooked River or 1838 Missouri or Mountain Meadows, while they might be quite troubling, should be less troubling to them than someone doubting and putting in historical fact some of the things about the origins. They treated Krakauer with great scathing. It made his the number one best-selling book in the nation. I suspect Grant may have wanted to have his book. He sells very well for signature. But inside, and having talked to him personally for some time about it, I think he'd rather have it the way it is, leaving him alone, relatively leaving him alone, and having just the amount of notoriety he has in this room. It's a nice step we've seen made here with his book. Of course, I doubt that I see an insider's view of Mormon origins as next year's priesthood manual. Grant is working on a new book. I have talked to people who have read some of the proofs of it, some of the originations of it. We have a very good mutual friend. I hope to see more of this kind of history where the author readily admits he still stays where he's at in his faith position, much like one of the speakers did last night in a very moving, touching session. Thanks for your time.
I see Grant Palmer's book as an exciting development in Mormon scholarship. Having said that, I need to clarify that Palmer's book is not a rigorous work by scholarly standards, nor is Palmer's thesis innovative. Essentially, this book argues that the canonical account of Mormon origins is not historically accurate. Joseph Smith's first vision of the Father and the Son, the translation of the Book of Mormon from golden plates, the restoration of priesthood authority by angelic ordination, the translation of the Book of Abraham from Egyptian papyri, none of these, Palmer asserts, actually happened the way we were taught in Sunday school. As I say, this isn't a new idea. Anti-Mormons have been making these claims since the 1830s, and the New Mormon historians have been making these claims in LDS circles since the 1960s. Some of the particulars Palmer uses to support his thesis were new to me, particularly his discussion of E.T. A. Hoffman's The Golden Pot. But in general, Palmer repeats assertions already made by Mormon scholars of a revisionist bent. Those assertions include the following. Accounts of Joseph Smith's first vision evolved from an evangelical conversion narrative typical of that time into the more spectacular and demanding story we know today. The Smiths and other foundational LDS figures subscribed to a magic worldview that would strike contemporary saints as implausible. The Book of Mormon anachronistically interjects religious controversies, practices, and rhetoric from Joseph Smith's day back into the ancient world. DNA testing does not support the church's claim that Israelites are the principal ancestors of the American Indians. The corrections in the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible reflect Joseph's own changing theology, not the intent of the original biblical authors. And Joseph did not have the ability to translate ancient documents, as evidenced by his false claims about the contents of the Chandler papyri and the Kinderhook plates. We've heard all of this before. So if Palmer's thesis isn't new, why do I find his book an exciting development? What's exciting about the book is the rhetorical position that Palmer occupies. As the title says, Palmer writes as a Mormon insider. Unlike many of the revisionist scholars whose work he draws on, Palmer has impeccable credentials as a mainstream Latter-day Saint. He's active in the church, a high priest group instructor, a former seminary teacher, and three-time institute director. As a retired CES employee, rather than an academic, Palmer is not your stereotypical intellectual. He's not a dissident. He doesn't have embarrassing ties to Mark Hoffman. He isn't noticeably a feminist. He isn't gay. He hasn't been excommunicated, at least not yet. He hasn't had to resort to calling himself an insider-outsider or a DNA Mormon or a cultural Mormon. His LDS identity is straightforward and unproblematic. That's not to say that writing this book hasn't created problems for him, but his 34 years as an institute director keep him from being readily dismissed as just one more so-called intellectual. This puts Palmer in a position that someone like Mike Quinn, Brent Metcalf, or Tom Murphy cannot occupy. Palmer does not speak from a position of academic authority, nor does he speak from the margins of the LDS community. He speaks from within the LDS mainstream with the authority of one clothed in the CES mantle. And that lends him a credibility that Orthodox saints can only regard as alarming. It's one thing when some secularized college professor questions the Book of Mormon's antiquity. It's quite another when your institute director questions the Book of Mormon's antiquity. Little wonder, then, that Lou Midgley showed up at one of Palmer's book signings last year to grill him about his status in the church. Palmer's book represents precisely what apologists seek to prevent: rank-and-file Latter-day Saints taking seriously the claims of revisionists. Revisionism is no longer confined to the fringes of the LDS community, Dialogue, Sunstone, and so on. Palmer is bringing revisionism into the mainstream, making a case for revisionist claims that will be readily accessible to saints outside intellectual circles. Being of a revisionist bent myself, I'm excited by this. If anyone can convince Latter-day Saints to embrace a way of understanding the Restoration that is less literal-minded, less dogmatic, less at odds with contemporary scholarship, if anyone can convince Latter-day Saints that their faith's validity does not depend on the historical accuracy of its foundational narratives, if anyone can do that, it will be people like Grant Palmer, people who occupy the rhetorical position that Palmer occupies. However, this book is not going to convince mainstream saints of the things I just said. The book is strong in making the case that Mormonism's foundational narratives are not historically accurate. But Palmer, as a professed insider, needs to do more than that. He also needs to show that Mormonism can be a living faith despite its foundational narratives not being historically accurate, that Mormonism can be true in a meaningful sense other than being historically true. If he doesn't do that, then Palmer's project is indistinguishable from recent films like The Lost Book of Abraham or DNA versus the Book of Mormon, in which evangelical Christians debunk foundational Mormon narratives, much as Palmer does, for the purpose of convincing Latter-day Saints to abandon Mormonism. Let me be more precise. If Palmer is going to convince mainstream saints that their faith is valid, even though it makes historically inaccurate claims, then he has to offer a convincing account for why people in the faith experience God's presence and power in their lives. Orthodoxy already provides such an account, predicated on the historical accuracy of Mormon faith claims. Latter-day Saints experience God's presence and power in their lives because the Restoration is the manifestation of God's presence and power in our times. The First Vision, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and other works of LDS Scripture, the restoration of the priesthood. To the Orthodox mind, these are all instances of God acting in history to carry out his work. Palmer walks readers through 8 chapters explaining why these purported events could not, in fact, have occurred as described, and thus he undermines the Orthodox explanation for why people experience God's presence and power through LDS Scripture and ritual. But Palmer doesn't offer a convincing or a compelling alternative explanation. Palmer insists that faith needs to be built on truth, by which he means historical truth, what actually occurred. He therefore insists that the saints need to deal with the challenges raised to canonical narratives by the new Mormon history. To address and ultimately correct this disparity between historical narratives and the inspirational stories that are told in church. He assures readers that this does not mean abandoning faith and spirituality, as in the following excerpt. Quote, "The New Mormon history's account of Mormon origins is much different from what we hear in the modified versions that are taught in Sunday school. But demythologized, placed in its original time and place, amid all the twists and turns that exist in the real world, it rings true. There has not been an attempt to eliminate the spiritual from the secular. Far from that, the foundational stories are in many cases more spiritual, less temporal, and more stirring. Whatever else, they are also fascinating. To know the personalities involved in these events and to hear them tell their experiences in their own original words before everything was recast for hierarchical and proselyting purposes is to see it all in an entirely new and exciting perspective. End of quote. This is meant to sound reassuring, even inspiring, but it's rather vague. What does it mean to say that the revisionist accounts are more spiritual, less temporal? How is the revisionist account more stirring than the Orthodox account? Palmer's enthusiasm for this fascinating, new, and exciting perspective seems largely cerebral, the thrill of the historian uncovering the truth. But how does this new and exciting perspective serve religion's pastoral functions? How does it give perspective or comfort to people confronting adversity or loss? How does it give people a sense that God is at work in their lives? Clearly, truth looms large in Palmer's religious sensibility. He is devoted to pursuing truth, no matter how uncomfortable it might make him, and no matter what cherished beliefs he might have to give up on the way. But I don't sense that most people come to religion because they're devoted to the uncompromising pursuit of truth. They come because they're looking for comfort, strength, meaning, and direction in a bewildering and painful world. Palmer wants the saints to embrace revisionism because it's true. But if he can't also show that revisionism provides comfort, strength, meaning, and direction, he won't have many takers. Orthodoxy already dominates the market when it comes to meeting Latter-day Saints' pastoral needs. Palmer hasn't shown that revisionism can compete. Palmer does address the pastoral side of religion when he writes of the joy he has experienced serving as director of the LDS Institute in the Salt Lake County Jail, where he focused on basic Bible teachings and provided counseling. He says that this work made him feel sustained and renewed by the loving Spirit of Christ. For Palmer, then, it seems that service is the key to experiencing God's presence and power in our lives. Palmer urges the saints to adopt a more practical approach to our religion, an emphasis on the character of Jesus Christ and his promises. This practical religion would be grounded in the virtues taught in the Beatitudes: humility, gentleness, forgiveness, honesty, peacemaking, returning good for evil. Central to this kind of religiosity is the sacrament, where we renew our covenant commitment to the Christian life, thus revealing Christ to the world through our lives. Palmer sees this religiosity as the solution to the challenges raised by the new Mormon history. He cites the Adventists and the RLDS Church as examples of religious groups who responded to the discovery that their foundational claims were historically unreliable by emphasizing Christ and minimizing their differences with other denominations. In other words, though he doesn't put it this bluntly, Palmer recommends that we respond to the new Mormon history by pushing aside the foundational narratives it debunks. Rather than insist on exclusive or unique claims to God's authority and revelation, the saints should instead focus on being good Christians, like the good Christians in other denominations. Less talk about angels and golden plates, more talk about service and the Sermon on the Mount. I'm not altogether thrilled about this proposal. I would like to see the covenant commitment to Christ-like living replace exclusive claims to truth and authority as the center of Mormon religiosity, but I would not want to see the LDS community follow the RLDS community down the road to becoming just one more Protestant denomination. I would not want to see the LDS community abandon what makes it distinctive: its unique canon, its temple rituals, its foundational narratives of angelic visitations and theophanies. Ironically, Palmer's proposal seems not unlike the agenda of the anti-Mormons who made DNA versus the Book of Mormon. The anti-Mormons want Latter-day Saints to respond to the realization that their foundational narratives aren't historical truth by becoming mainline Christians. Palmer wants Latter-day Saints to respond to the realization that their foundational narratives aren't historical truth by becoming mainline Christians. Besides, I'm not sure how focusing on Christ actually solves the problem of historicity. Surely Palmer is aware that scholars have challenged the historicity of Christian foundational narratives in the same way that Palmer himself challenges Mormon foundational narratives. So if Palmer is resting his faith on Christian foundational claims, he must be doing one of two things. Either he's ignoring the challenges that have been raised against Christian faith claims, in which case he's doing the same thing he laments that Latter-day Saints do, or he has found a way to make those foundational narratives meaningful regardless of their historical validity. But if he can do that for Christianity's foundational narratives, why can't we do the same for Mormonism's foundational narratives? There is a hint, actually, that Palmer thinks this might be possible. He speaks of the foundational narratives at one point in his book as allegories. Unfortunately, he doesn't elaborate. Allegories of what? In the end, my assessment of an insider's view of Mormon origins is akin to my assessment of Mark Thomas's Digging in Cumorah, which I reviewed last year for Sunstone Magazine. In both cases, I'm excited by the possibilities these books represent for creating a Mormonism that can tolerate people who don't believe in Mormon foundational claims as literal historical truth. But both authors stop short of taking a crucial step, showing readers how a revisionist approach to Mormonism can meet people's spiritual needs. It's not enough to insist that the revisionist account is true. It's not enough to talk vaguely about allegories or stirring new perspectives. We need to move away from debunking canonical narratives and spend more time reclaiming the narratives. How do Joseph Smith's visions, understood as sacred story rather than history, shape our lives? How does God communicate to us through Joseph's writings? How do the ordinances Joseph established provide us with spiritual sustenance and direction? When people in Grant Palmer's position start writing about that, then there will be hope for successfully promoting a less literal-minded Mormonism.
I appreciate the opportunity to share a few minutes with you here. I've appreciated the comments that have been made up to this point, and find myself resonating with some of the dichotomies that have been touched on and some of the ways that those have been presented. I find myself, after reading Grant Palmer's book, much like, if you'll allow me a personal story, much like my daughter at SeaWorld this past week. In a visit to SeaWorld, we were presented with a number of shows that had as their basis a number of allegedly spontaneous events, people being called out of the audience, including one family, the mother of which ends up falling into a pool and being rescued by a dolphin, only to find out that the mother was in fact one of the trainers. My daughter uttered a sentence that I thought was quite mature. She said, "The thing that's so embarrassing about this is that somebody has watched me believe." After confronting that initial feeling here, I find that I have a number of responses in addition to the well-articulated presentation here about providing a suitable alternative. It seemed to me that this book did something for me that I hadn't realized before. And first of all, how many of you have read this book? That's great. Probably will be a bestseller. The thing that this did for me was to level the playing field. Sometimes it's important for us to have heroes, but when those heroes become mythologized or take on superhuman proportions, it's not possible for a layperson to see how those experiences are available in their own personal lives. As I watched, as I read the different descriptions throughout this book, my mind was taken to a number of things that are becoming of increased importance, and perhaps most of you have experienced the same type of thing. The first thing is Midrashic revelation. How many are familiar with that term, Midrash revelation? In a Jewish sense, as I understand it, Midrash revelation is where you are confronted with the writings on a particular topic and confronted with conflicting points of view. What is it that happens within your soul, within your mind, and your creativity, and what comes out as the creative effort? It seems to me, as I read the narrative here, that Joseph Smith was involved in Midrashic style revelation. And I know that there have been a number of articles written in Dialogue and in other places about this type of revelation, but it seems to me that not only was Joseph Smith involved with this, but we too are involved with this type of revelation process, and it leveled the playing field for me. This is available to all of us. The a book that was written by E.F. Schumacher entitled The Nature of Problems states as its hypothesis that there are two general types of problems. One is a type of problem that has an empirical base. It converges on a single solution. For example, if you wish to invent or solve the problem of two-wheeled personal-powered transportation, people will converge on inventing the bicycle, and this may pop up in a variety of locations as people try to solve that problem. The other type of problem is non-empirical problems, problems that involve metaphysics, problems that involve spiritual awakening and personal spiritual experiences. The closer, much like quantum mechanics in examining the electron, when the closer you look at where it should be, the less you can quantify it. And so it is with this type of problem. The closer you look at the origins and the personal spiritual experiences, the more you realize that you have a divergent problem on your hands and you are left with holding a paradox. And you need to be able to hold the paradox and not be bumped to one side or another. Life is full of paradoxes. There are a number of references to this particular process in the book. For example, Grant refers to the leaders of various religious movements and in his book and the origins of those particular religions, and quotes B.H. Roberts, I believe it was, in analyzing that and stating that as you examine the religious experiences of all of those people, there are divergences. There is no single religious tenet that you can quantify or objectify. And that describes the nature of the experience that we're dealing with here. I thought that that was a good analysis. In his closing thesis, Grant states that it's his hope that this book will lead us to Christ and lead us to a more personal relationship with Christ. I found that it did. I found that it did in the following regard. Because the revelatory process and the creative process is personal, and because it's at least as important to be creative as it is to be obedient, the relationship, and because it's important to recognize that while we have people whose experience we can learn from, we do not need to interpose them as heroes between ourselves and our God, that we realize that the religious experience is in fact a personal experience and in fact is personal with Christ and God. You can really judge the efficacy of a particular position by analyzing its works, not its myths, but its works. By their works ye shall know them. And that provides the closest thing to an empirical test that we have. And I think that by leveling the playing field by making personal revelation the name of the game, that that is, in fact, a good work. In closing, I would just like to say that the implication that Joseph Smith was not divinely inspired because of all of these contemporaneous sources, which seems to be an implication to me of the book, I believe does not necessarily hold. I believe that takes one step beyond where it needs to go. The fact is that all of us are influenced by contemporaneous material of a variety of ways. And through a recent interest in hypnotherapy and past life regression and various clients that I've had, and also various clients that my wife has dealt with, we have seen that there are a variety of experiences, including channeling, including personal personal experiences in type of personal life regression, as well as seeing things that are beyond this life, both in other lives and between lives, that suggest that there is a body of information there that is accessible to all of us, that allows us to take the things that we see in everyday life, that allows us to take the patterns and the things that we see in our lives and use those to draw us to Christ and our relationship with Him. And I saw that idea supported in the writings here as some of the myths that have surrounded our origins were placed in a more historical context. The question finally is, why do we experience God's presence? We experience God's presence because He loves us, because He has a plan of happiness for us, and I think that all of that was supported and can be strengthened by continued analysis of the things that Grant Palmer has presented. Thanks.
I appreciate the preparation, the comments each of you have made, Mel and John Charles and Bill, and thank you for coming. I think the criticisms were by and large justified. John Charles talks about, I haven't spelled out where do we go from here. I want you to know I tried. Signature book. I tried to get my second book attached to the first book because that's where I think we should be going, and many, many examples of that. For those interested, it will be out Easter. It's called The Incomparable Jesus, and it's mentioned in the conclusion of the first book. I don't have all the answers. I think we're feeling our way along here, and I think we'll have a dialogue about this as time goes on. Let me just say a few things about how the book came to be, and we'll go from there. When I was working on my doctor's degree at BYU, I had four focus areas: ancient history, American religions, and LDS history and Western history, actually five areas. I never did complete it. I guess I didn't have a big enough ego. They wouldn't pay you for it in CES if you got a PhD anyway, and it takes about 6 years in history, 6 to 8 years. So anyway, I didn't finish it, but I did all the coursework and some of the other requirements. But it was in American religions, where I began to do a lot of study of the Methodist sermons, especially the evangelical Methodist sermons of that era, the Second Great Awakening. And the more I looked, the more I found numerous sermons that seemed to match up with Enos, clear through Alma 2, 11 or 12 or 13 prophets in the Book of Mormon. And it wasn't just their language that was similar. It was the conversion process. It was the taking certain texts modified from the King James Bible. It was had to do with style, form, pattern. It was all there, and it was just amazing to me that it looked to me like, having read the Methodist sermons, and we probably should pay more attention to Joseph saying that he was somewhat partial to the Methodists. I think he was quite a bit partial to the Methodists. The theology is of man is Methodist Arminianism. The nature of God in the Book of Mormon, and so forth. Anyway, I took that body of material and I just set it aside, and I went back to the Institute, and then another element that emerged was the amount of the Bible in the Book of Mormon, and it's very, very extensive, far more extensive, the King James Bible in the Book of Mormon, than even many of you who are sitting here know. And certainly of the general church membership. It's true that Lucy Smith said that Joseph never read the Bible all the way through, but my goodness, the parts that he read, he knew them well. And all you've got to do is look at section 4 in the Doctrine and Covenants, and it's rather brilliant. That's the one we use in missionary work. The field is wide already to harvest. And I went through that short revelation and found 14 phrases spontaneously intermixed with that revelation that are right out of the Bible. 3 to 8 words right out of the King James Bible 14 times. I don't know about you, but I don't know very many people could do that today in the church. Maybe Elder Neil Maxwell. He's simply imbued with this. He has a very good mind. He has a very creative imagination. And the Kinderhook plates denotes that. The treasure hunting. He'll describe what men look like on the moon. I mean, it's all there. It's a very creative imagination and a very good mind. And you put that together, he's simply imbued with the evangelical fervor of his day. I had to study it for my PhD in libraries. He was living it. And I think he gave a lot of the answers that he wanted to give on those issues of that day. The third, maybe 50 stories, examples of the Bible just jumped out at me over the years, and I kind of put that aside. That was the second influence. The third influence was B.H. Roberts in his view of the Hebrews, and B.H. Roberts convinced me that American antiquities were simply being discussed by people of his day of all ranks, and they're just that's a part of him too. For a structural outline, as B.H. Roberts would say. But what caused me to write the book was the fourth influence, and that was E.T.A. Hoffman's The Golden Pot. And that is new to this book. It's never been enumerated before. And Ronald W. Walker, a pretty good historian at BYU, was doing some research for Steve Christensen, and he was doing some background on the Salamander letter, you may recall. And one day he just put in Salamander into the computer, and he got all these books and brought them home and read them. And when he read The Golden Pot by E.T.A. Hoffman, it was a book, a novel, a short story written in 1814. He said to me one day, he says, I want you to read this and let's get together. I want to talk briefly. The outline of the story is that a young theology student by the name of Anselmus decides that his life is kind of humdrum and boring, and he works for his conrector is a man named Pullman, but he goes off into these daydreams, and he and his religious professor becomes Lindhorst. Archivarius Lindhorst, who lives in, he's the last archivist of the Atlantean civilization. And sure enough, young Anselmus has three dreams in one night, very much same content as you get out of verses 23 through 64 in the Pearly Great Prize of the Joseph Smith history. Then he has a dream the next morning, and it's very similar. And then he gets... I should back up just a bit. When Anselmus goes to get the ancient records to translate the history of this Atlantean society, this lost civilization, he gets abused by a white serpent. And it appears in the same place in the story that Joseph Smith, some of the accounts, place his being abused by a white serpent. So he's kind of, after the fourth morning vision, he gets reprimanded after a while by Lindhorst for not coming and being engaged in the work. And why doesn't he want to do that? Because he got beat up at the doorstep of this Atlantean archivist. And he also encountered the evil power, and he didn't want to come. If you read Lucy Smith's history, she says Joseph, sure enough, was reprimanded, almost the same phrase, for not being engaged enough in the work. Well, it goes from there. Lindhorst is displeased, says, I want you to come back 1 year from today, and we'll talk. He does so on the fall equinox, and he gets that record. He takes his wife or his fiancée with him, and they're there from midnight till dawn on the equinox. Young Anselmus, as is Joseph Smith and Emma, and he gets that record on the gold on the equinox, and he translates it by the gift and power of God. Michael Quinn, in his book, is convinced most Latter-day Saints who read these things that the Smiths were involved in folk magic. This book crosses a second bridge and shows how it impacts on the 11 witnesses of the Book of Mormon and the angel gold plate story. The last two chapters of the book have to do with the last four, the angel gold plate story, the witnesses, the priesthood restoration, and the first vision. I found that they all evolve, all four of them. The first one to do so was the witnesses of the gold plates. I think they saw them. The key to understanding those witnesses, I believe, is they see the same things they testify to inside the cave of Cumorah by second sight, or the eyes of our understanding, is the way it is used in Scripture. In other words, it's a metaphysical thing, but that is written by Joseph as a physical, literal viewing of the plates, especially by the eight. They weren't going to sign it. The eight were not going to sign it. Joseph persuaded them, and I think I know why. Because in Mormonism, that which is spiritual is physical, is real, is material. It's in section 96 and 67 of the Doctrine and Covenants and so forth. The Angel Gold Plate story also evolves, and that does so in about 1830, a year later, and it becomes more unique, more biblical, more impressive, and the same is true of the priesthood, which changed in 35, and the first vision, which changed in 38. In the case of priesthood restoration, it goes from spiritual impressions to perception of angels to the appearance and ordination by physically resurrected beings. In the case of the first vision, that too becomes more impressive. For 12 years, Joseph is called by Moroni. That's what all the missionaries understood. But when he gets in trouble with all of his witnesses of the Book of Mormon and three or four apostles who've left the church because they do not believe in the historical reality of the Book of Mormon, that's when he changes that he's called by God, the Eternal Father, and Jesus Christ. What is going to happen to all of this? You know, for years we've been told in CES that the evidence for and against the historical reality of the Book of Mormon is about 50-50. I think that is dramatically shifting. I'd say more like 80-20. And it's going to be interesting to see where that goes in the future. I'm glad to be alive to watch it. I don't have a poll on that kind of statistic of 80-20. But I know when I started in CES 35 years ago, I did not know one CES teacher who did not believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Today I know a dozen in Salt Lake Valley, and there are more outside. I suspect that the closet doubter is spilling out into the living room, the dining room, and the kitchen. And it'll be interesting to see where this goes. This is kind of new territory, John Charles, and I think we'll have to work together as to where this goes. I just know that in my experience in sacrament meeting, we drop the name of Jesus Christ, we mention him, but there's not a lot of discussion about him. There's more on the general level of the church. There's more in the ensign, but on the weekly meetings. Now this year we're studying the life of Jesus, but we only do that for several months, once every 4 years. To me, I'd like to see more of Jesus Christ and less of just about everything else. And I don't know that we need to just completely modify Mormonism. I have no problem with people who go to the temple. I think that tries to make them more Christ-centered. I don't see the covenants in the temple sometimes correlating with the questions they ask you to go to the temple, however. And some of those seem to be a little more control-oriented than what you're actually making a covenant to and who you're making it with in the temple. But I guess that's my take on this, and we're going to have plenty of time for questions, and I hope you'll feel free to ask them. I'll try to give the best answer we have, and the panelists as well. Thank you.
Just a quick comment. If you have a question, we'd prefer that you come up here so that we'll be on the tape. If you'd prefer to stay there and it's a short question, our panelists will repeat it for the basis of the tape. If you have a comment to make, you better come up here. because if you make a comment down there, it will be totally lost, and the response from up here won't make a lot of sense. So,
I need to sign my copy while I'm asking the question.
Thank you. I want to preface my question with two premises. Premise one, that one can find encounter a personal experience with God outside of Christianity, and a corollary to that, that one can encounter have a personal experience with Christ outside of Mormonism. Premise two, there's probably not a person in this blessed room right now who's wearing temple garments because they're comfortable. I guess along with that, a cold beer would probably go down really well right now. So here's my question. Why stay in the church as opposed to simply identify yourself as a generic Christian who happens to hold intellectual admiration and interest with a few doctrines that are unique to Mormonism and perhaps to a number of other religions as well?
That's for you.
Thank you.
Well, that's for each person to decide, and I respect the differing ways people handle this. For me, I'm a fourth generation. I've got children. I've got grandchildren. It's my heritage. I'm hoping we can become more Christ-centered, and maybe that's naive. I don't know. I think it needs to happen. I think we're being driven to this by our history isn't coming up to what we were told, and so I have a hope that that will be the case. And as for staying in, when I participate, I try to emphasize the Lord Jesus Christ. He promises in those sacramental prayers that we'll have His Spirit be with Him if we'll remember Him. But you got to talk about Him to remember Him in the sacrament meeting. He promises we'll have His peace to be with us. He promises us that He'll bring His truth to our remembrance, and He says He'll manifest or reveal Himself in our lives. I believe that. I've had enough experience with that in my own life to answer that question for myself, and I just like to see a little more emphasis in that direction. I think if you ask active adults in the church to give a brief overview of the ministry of Joseph Smith, they can do it. It's like that. What's 1820, 1823, 1827, 1829, 1830, and a ministry in Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, and he's martyred him. Try that on active LDS to give a brief overview of the general ministry of Jesus Christ, and you will get some very blank stares. But each person has to decide that for himself, what they feel, what they experience. And the Mormon sense of community is wonderful. I'm grateful that I had it growing up. It did a lot for me. But each person needs to answer that for themselves.
Enjoyed your book very much, as I told you yesterday in the hall. I wonder if you could tell us what kind of reaction you've had from various groups, your former bosses in CES, your former colleagues in CES, your ecclesiastical leaders, and just your colleagues in the church, if any of them, like people in your ward or whoever, if people normal. Mormons who don't come to Sunstone, but who you might know and who have read it.
That's quite a question. Well, I'll start with my family. My mother will not look at even the cover of the book. Four of my six brothers will not talk about it or read it. Two and a half of my children have not read the book. One of them's read it slightly. Another's read it fully. They generally just don't want to talk about it. As for my ward, quite a few of them read it while I was convalescing down in San Diego for the winter, and when I came back, the bishop was anxious to see me. He wanted to know why I wrote it. We met with the stake president and the bishop and myself, and they were interested in why I wrote it, and I gave them five or six reasons, and then I explained that I was a heretic, not an apostate. Believe it or not, I think they kind of liked that. I'm not receiving any new callings. They released me from the high priest teaching position, and they released all other teachers and the whole group leadership. It's hard for me to get paranoid about that because I did teach them for 16 years. So, the response from CES, I'm sure that I did get one. My immediate boss gave a book review to the institute director or teachers up at the U of U, and I think he's not qualified to probably critique the book very well, but I think he was defining what he believed, and it was quite different from what I have in my book. Other than that, one anonymous letter, it's been very, very positive, and I've got letters and emails from all over the world, Scotland, Australia, everywhere, and it's been very gratifying. It's helped balance out some of these more immediate responses in my own family. I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I could very well be thrown out of the church, and I guess as Sterling McMurrin would say, I don't know if they want a person like me in the church or not, but they never did throw him out, and boy, they had some reasons to do so, but they didn't. Did I miss one of those categories? Oh, the ward members. They're very interesting. I've been going out of my way to make comments in Sunday school about the Sunday school studying of Jesus, and they look around and think, well, that wasn't too bad a comment for a heretic. I even bore my testimony about 2 months ago, and I know some of them just held their breath. I bore it about Christ, and I the ward was very supportive. I had kind of a lousy year last year. I had cancer, I had three different operations, and 6 months of chemo and another 6 weeks of radiation. I'm happy to see that year go. By the way, I was editing my book during that time, and I had chemo moments, I can tell you that. They've been very nice. They've been polite, most of them. Some of them are not quite as friendly, but I don't want to be too paranoid about that. But I'm there, and I make comments. And frankly, I wish some of you'd come back, and we'd all raise our hand at the same time.
Just a quick aside. I think if the hierarchy would prefer us to be heretics rather than apostates, you can burn heretics, but apostates tend to just disappear. So.
I use the word heterodox. I'm a self-described heterodox member, but a lot of thoughts have gone through my mind, and I haven't read your book, but I keep on thinking about my home ward. I think about, and I can't tell if I'm the Grand Inquisitor that wants to protect my ward from the truth, or if I'm some kind of Gnostic that holds the key to sacred knowledge that only a few rarefied people who are willing to go through the tomes of revisionist history claim certain knowledge. As I understand your book, it's a more accessible way to come to a revisionist point of view, and I have mixed feelings about that. And I think it stems partly because I feel something like a parasite in my ward. There's no way that I'll ever be a bishop or a flock, a person.
Not with that beard, you will.
No. But there's that was the prior session. But there's just, I depend for my spiritual sustenance, I depend on there being a vital, thriving faith that is rock solid and core and something that people don't have to have a postmodern ironic kind of attitude about to keep their faith going. And I'm on the margins. I'm on the fringe of that. I participate. I'm not totally on the fringe, but I don't think a ward of people like ourselves or like me would last very long, frankly. Because I don't know, I just have this doubt in my mind that people just like me would be able to pull it off. And so I really do think that the questions raised by the critics and in your response of saying, I don't know where we're going, let's find out, I'm not satisfied at all with that. I think there's a moral imperative associated with these revealing of truths that we need to think through. And I don't want to certainly say, let's not say these things, but I do think we have to think through very carefully what kind of church we are trying to support.
I'm just saying I don't have all these answers. I think the answer is to move dramatically to Jesus Christ, and that's what my second book's about. And I've got ideas that I think would help there. That's all I'm saying. I guess.
What you're really talking about is what you call delicately the evolution of Joseph's stories. Those of us who are less delicate would call lies. My question for you is, what do you say to people that when you broach the possibility that Joseph Smith may not have only been perhaps mistaken in what he saw, but an outright fabricator, evolving a story that fitted the need, as in the restoration of the Aaronic priesthood, how does that square with a belief that must maintain in you to keep active in the church, that he was right on so many other things? In other words, a prophet can be mistaken, still be a prophet. I think most people would agree, the human frailty. Can a prophet lie and still get revelation?
Somebody else want to answer that? I don't. Joseph responds in crisis to more miraculous versions. That's all I can tell you. He's quite human. I don't know what to say beyond that.
I'm not going to answer that question.
Oh, I thought you were. Get me off the hook here. I have seen. I had a doctor call me, and he paced for 3 days in Sandy, or 3 weeks up and down. He says, if I could only talk to that guy. Finally, his wife called me and says, he'll give you $100 if you go to lunch with him and tell him how you remain active in the church, knowing all this stuff. And. And after he was through, he says, that ought to be your church calling. I guess I helped him a little. I don't know, but that's the way he said. He said, that ought to be your calling in the church. So I don't know. I got a patriarchal blessing when I was 17, said I'd help the wayward, and I always thought that was the jailbirds. But
I want to take just a slightly different cut at that. I mentioned that I teach gospel doctrine part-time. Paul, when he talks about the vision that he saw, describes it three different ways. Or people writing about it and Paul describe it three different ways. I saw, the people with him saw and did not hear. They hear and did not see. And when he describes it himself, probably talking about himself with a man caught up into Jesus, he describes he's caught up into a vision, which was more norm for that time as opposed to someone coming down. That's not the only time we meet these inconsistencies and these changing of stories in scriptures that most of us, that we can talk about the historicity there also, and he'll approach that in his next book, I understand. At the meeting in Jerusalem, which I teach, 15th chapter of Acts, I teach day after tomorrow, we have a meeting of the hierarchy with James, not of Peter, James, and John, the James, the brother of Christ, who's apparently leading the meeting, who makes the decision. We have a description of the meeting there, but yet we go to where Paul himself describes that meeting, and it's like it's an entirely different meeting. Entirely different. Through these scriptural means that at least we can talk about historicity, but Paul existed as a person, and these were historical things. We see in other scriptures these same kind of changes. I want to take a slight cut at something else that we talked about, and it was an excellent question about, you know, yeah, we have a few doctrines, and it was a wonderful question. We go where we're comfortable. We go where, like Maxine Hanks said, where everyone needs a community. And I'm in the LDS community, not because I was born in this community. I'm a convert to the church early, 13, and definitely some of my family had Mormon roots, but it's my wife who's a descendant of Parley Pratt, not me. I'm a descendant of a bunch of people who probably didn't care if they went to church or not. And so to me, these were new, different, innovative, health codes, way of life, eternal marriage, which he mentions a little. My one thing of his book I didn't talk about, where he says he thinks some things are so great that Joseph gave and lists a couple. He said he could enumerate more. I cried and yelled at the book, enumerate them. The openness of Joseph Smith to new things, the history of the King Follett discourse, free agency, I could name some others. Things I don't like, the top-down structure of the political crab, Main Street Plaza, not treating historical problems directly, trying to hide them, lie about them. But the things I do like are so wonderful. And I like my ward, not that all is wonderful. The first week I was there, the substitute teacher in Doctrinal Doctrine gave an anti-evolution talk. Mike Ash is here. He'd written an article on evolution. Some of you may know. I know a little about the topic of the church and evolution. I claim no expertise in either, but in the intersection, I think I have an expertise. And I literally quoted to him the 1909, 1925, 1931, and the Encyclopedia of Mormonism entry on of evolution, which destroys his whole argument very quickly. And I quoted them absolutely directly because I happen to have in my Bible the statements in case it ever comes up. A couple of weeks later, the regular teacher was there and talked about Joseph Smith translating the Book of Mormon with his head in his hat and a stone. A year later, the same teacher talked about the Book of Abraham not matching the papyri. So it's not like I'm alone in the ward. And I'm not saying it's the norm for that ward. They tolerate her. She's now the Relief Society president. They tolerate me, not as a heretic, but as a normal member of the ward. And I'm not sure that's unique. I know that's not the norm for what some of you face. And one more brief comment. I hesitate taking so long. I referred before to Father Raymond Brown, and he's a marvelous author. And if you want to take the same kind of approach that Grant and Mike here take about history, and Mike Quinn and Todd Compton and other of these heroes who've written so extensively, you want to take that about scriptures, get Raymond Brown's Birth of the Messiah. He's a very thick book, about 600 pages, I'm guessing, 650, 700 pages. It's only about five chapters in Luke and Matthew, the birth stories. He literally takes them apart, debunks them, talks about what magi was, talks about the innumerable problems of borrowing, wholesale borrowing from Old Testament stories. He talks about them very directly. And on the fly jacket, I believe, and I haven't read the book in 6 years, it talks about in some unique way, by tearing apart these things piece by piece and bringing down to the lowest possible thing, by talking about their metaphysical type origins and the borrowing, somehow in this, he comes to the position of greater faith. And like Grant said that I quoted early, somehow in all of this finding, I find myself on a greater faith threshold. I can't, John David, put it into words, and I can talk about it a little, but I find myself in a stronger position personally inside myself than I did before. That was my thoughts on some of the questions.
Okay, I'm 20 and I feel like I'm in the minority of my age group here. So I apologize if this question doesn't apply to everyone. But as I thought about the same thing as to how you have remained so active in the church and faithful in the church while researching and writing this about the history, I keep coming back to what you express about the appreciation you have for your heritage and your ancestry in the church. And I often wonder, if you had written and researched and published this book at my age, if it would have been the same, if you would still be as faithful in the church before you had built your life, your marriage and your family and your career on the foundations of Mormonism. And so I guess my general question is, what advice you would give to people who are, you know, who are my age and coming across this already, what direction would you point us in how to bring our faith and our intellect into line and make them match up?
I have a 22-year-old son who thinks like you. Are you married?
No.
Well, I say in the preface, this is not for children or converts, and I don't know if you're, I guess 20 doesn't quite qualify you as a child or a young person. I probably would have had more problems with it when I was your age if I'd have known this, but it's coming. It's like a train. I don't know how we're going to avoid this. What advice would I have? I would say just... like I've said before, I would, when you're asked to speak or teach or emphasize Jesus Christ, you sing, bear your testimony. That kind of focus is what I would recommend. I recommend that for myself at my age, so I would recommend it for you for your age. Yes.
Gladly.
Well, I just say one other thing. Sometimes it gets so bad in priesthood meeting, I don't go every week.
Here's my advice to you, as someone who has not so long ago been in your position. I'm not that much older than you. First of all, we need to be realistic here. The church is never going to embrace revisionism. The absolute most we can ever hope for is that the church will tolerate revisionists, which right now it doesn't do terribly well. If you are beginning to have doubts that the canonical account is historically reliable, then one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to leave the church, or you may adopt some kind of I value it as my heritage position, which isn't terribly convincing, and will probably eventually lead to you leaving the church. Or you need to have a testimony. And I don't mean by that you need to have warm, fuzzy experiences that convince you that, oh, I guess the experiences must be historically accurate. What I mean by that is you have to believe in the marrow of your bones that God is speaking to you through this faith tradition. Now, what that will mean, though, is that you will find yourself still on the margins of the LDS community because you will no longer believe that it's historically accurate, which means you will believe in a different way than most Mormons believe. And you will not be orthodox. You will have a different take on the faith. And you will not feel the same kinds of obligations that the Orthodox feel. You know, you will pick and choose in some ways. There will be parts of the tradition where God speaks to you and parts where you decide that that's not God speaking. But that's what you have to do. You have to have that kind of a testimony or you're not going to get through. You won't survive in this church.
Thank you.